discussion. We're not going to bow down because we know our God is able to deliver us. And then you have to love this. Even if he doesn't, what? We're not going to bow down. So it doesn't matter if he saves us or not. We're just going to be true to him. Of course, God sent his delivering servant to save him. So chapter 4, we see another dream of Nebuchadnezzar. We call it insomnia, insanity, and insight. And what was that one about? That was last week. So I know it was a long time ago. I'm sorry? All right, because what prompted this? What was he doing on his rooftop? Pride. He said, look all that my hands have done. But the truth was, who had done it for him? Yeah, well, the lesson we have to learn out of Daniel, it's repeated over and over and over. We're going to see it again tonight, that God is in the charge of kingdoms of men. God raises up nations. God raises up kings, and he disposes of them too. And when we say kings, does that include presidents and prime ministers, any type of ruler? Yes. God is in charge. And you might ask, well, how does he do it? And the answer is, we don't know, because he doesn't reveal to us how he does that. Sometimes we get some indication, but we know he's in charge. And when you doubt it, well, you're going to... Doubting God's rule and his sovereignty is going to have consequences in your life. And that's what we're going to learn in chapter 5, where we see, again, the handwriting on the wall. So when we look at this and open it up, someone wants to read for me chapter 5, verse 1. Someone raise your hand, the first one there. Go, Brad. Yes. Okay, so who are we introduced to here? Now, have we heard of Belshazzar before? No. Who has been the king up until now that we've talked about? Nebuchadnezzar. Well, not exactly, but that's close, all right? So the question is, who is Belshazzar and where did he come from? So on your chart, the handout I gave you, you see on the right-hand side, there's a list of kings. And so we want to look at that. Who is Belshazzar the king? So when you look at it, Nebuchadnezzar reigned from 605, and that's when they conquered Israel and took the Jews into captivity. And he ruled for about 40 years, 40 plus years. And after that, it was his son, and they call him evil, but actually he was... not all evil, but he released Jehoiakim, the king, back to Israel. He ruled for about 4 years, okay? Then there's another fellow, his son, Nergalezer, and then this guy only ruled 9 months. And then the last king of Babylon is Nabonidus, and he ruled from 556 to 539 when the kingdom of Babylon come to abrupt end. Now, nowhere in this list do you find Belshazzar. Look at all the history. And so, you know what all the skeptics of the Bible would say? What would they say? The Bible made it up. It's a mistake. It's inaccurate. You can't rely on the Bible. But guess what happens when they're digging in the dirt? And that's called archaeology. It's the greatest gig in the world. You get to play in the dirt and dig things up and discover things that are really, really, really old. They found the Nabonidus cylinder, and its names Belshazzar in it. Now, that's very interesting. It names him just like the Bible does. Now, they found him in another place, but it turns out that Belshazzar was the oldest son of this king, but this guy was more of a priest, and he was more involved in other things, and he lived in another city, so he let his son be co-regent or king in the city of Babylon itself. And that's why Daniel, when he writes and names him as king, was he correct? But who was the real acting king over the whole empire? All right, this other fella. The other thing, he could have died, because at this time, when we're looking at chapter 5, the Medo-Persian Empire has been taking down some of the cities of the Babylonian reign. In fact, we're going to see that Cyrus the Great has encamped the city of Babylon, and the city is under siege when this chapter opens, all right? And so we are nearing the end of the Babylonian Empire. So at that time, how old would Daniel be? Oh, he's an old man. That's the answer I wanted. You said 90? That works for me. All right? Because it's been nearly 70 years. He went as a young boy. So if he was 15 or somewhere there, he's 85, 90 years old. This is the end of Daniel's life. Now, so Nebuchadnezzar, the one, had the intimate relationship, well, the more personal relationship. And it seems like as these new rulers come about, they have forgotten who Daniel is. Maybe he's retired. Maybe he just has a secondary or really no role at all, but they really don't know who he is. So it's interesting. It names again Belshazzar as a co-regent with the king. So you can see this in the British Museum. So when you go there, make sure you look it up. It's not very long. It's actually really small, but they find these cylinders where that's how they recorded their history. It's just an interesting way because they didn't have paper like we do, and these would last, well, they lasted until now. So again, is the Bible accurate once again? Absolutely. Archaeology proves it, and you can rely on the Bible being true. So Brad, since you started, why don't you read through verse 4? Okay, so here he's going to have this banquet. It's really just a large party, and he's invited 1,000 of his nobles. Okay, that'd probably be not just the rulers, but, you know, captains and people in the army and people that are in charge. Now, and it's a drinking party, isn't it? Because he's drinking wine in front of the 1,000. Now, he's going to ask for all these silver and gold vessels. Where did they come from, all these vessels? The temple. Now, when did that happen? When Nebuchadnezzar besieged and sacked the city, they looted the temple and took all the beautiful artifacts back to Babylon. It's been suggested the reason he did this might be because when I bring out the remnants, the beautiful artifacts of a conquered city, it shows two things. One, how great I am, right? Let's just remember how I sacked that city and that nation. Well, not him personally, but Babylon. And also, it might inspire his nobles, because at this time, as we understand it, the city is under siege. Okay? Yes. Oh, good question. Yeah, and that's just a figure of speech. We'd use it just like Israel. They talk about our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that might be, you know, five generations removed or more. And so when you think of Nebuchadnezzar, he was the glorious king that started all this. So that's why he refers to him as that. That's a good question, though. For the tape, people were asking, why is he called Nebuchadnezzar his father? Yes, JC.
Young's literal keeps translating it as forefathers.
All right, and that's fine. Yeah, did you hear that? It calls him forefathers rather than father. Yes.
Like Moses became a father to Pharaoh.
Right. Yeah, he says that exactly the same thing. All right, so he takes them out of the temple, and it also, it might, like I say, inspire them. You know, we can do this because we've been victorious in the past. Now, I got to ask the question, why a party at such time? I thought I had it on here. Oh, okay, it's coming up. I'm sorry. They bring him out, and when they bring him out, his wives, his concubines, the nobles, they drank from him. And when they're drinking, what do? They worship the gods, and here it is, of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Now you got to put two and two together. Why is this so offensive to our God? Where did they come from?
They came from the temple.
And they were sanctified and used and made for
worship
to Jehovah, the only true and living God. And now here, this ruler, Belshazzar, takes them, and they were taken, stolen from the temple. And now in his drunken feast here, he uses them to drink and offer worship to his idols. So you're taking that which is something which has been set apart for God, and you're taking it in defiance, and it's almost like raising your fist at Jehovah saying, see, our gods are more powerful than you. Because we are taking artifacts from your temple because we destroyed your people and your city. That means you're not powerful at all. And now we're using them to offer worship to our gods. Is that defiance? Is that just blasphemous? Right. There's some lessons learned here, because when we look at life, I'll just set this up and we'll come back to it later. What has been made for God, or by God and for God?
Everything.
Your bodies, he said, are not yours. You've been bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your bodies. All the wealth he's given us. All the health he's given us. All the blessings he's given us. All the natural resources, the land, the soil, the mountains, the air. It's all given to us by God, and it's here to glorify God. And when we ever dare use it for something other than that, well, we are really like slapping God in the face. And we'll say, well, what do you mean? We'll try to come back to that later. You see what's happening here? It's defiance of who Jehovah is. So now, I mean, I got to ask the question, why a party in the first place? Because after all, what's going on outside the city walls? We're being attacked. Now, it's just interesting. It's just sometimes what people do when there's really danger, they just kind of say, well, let's go party and forget about it. Just turn a blind eye to it. But there's more going on than just that, because history records, here's the city with the river Euphrates going through it. It was, when we look at just the best conservative facts about the city, here they are. First of all, it was 14 square miles big. We already talked about it had two sets of walls, twin walls. The outer walls were 17 miles long. Now, some of these walls, remember I said there was four chariots could ride abreast on them? Some said they were 22 feet thick and 90 feet tall. Now, that's debated. Some even take them taller and some take shorter. But we're talking about a tall wall, 22 feet, and there was 250 watchtowers around the perimeter, and they are another 100 feet higher than the wall. Those would be guard towers. And there are 150 gates made not of stone, not of wood, of bronze or brass. So they're very impenetrable, okay? And then not only that, there's these inner and outer walls, there's these moats that are 30 feet wide. And so, of course, they're always filled with what? At least in the movies. What's in the moats? Alligators, that's right. Okay? So, if you have this type of secure city, what would you do just to thumb your nose at the army surrounding you? Let's go have a party. And I think that's exactly what's going on. Because they said also they had provisions for 20 years of siege. In other words, supplies in the city to stay alive. That's a lot, and I don't know how they preserve it, but I'm just telling you what I've read and studied, okay? So what would this produce in the leader of that city, even though they're under siege? Huh?
Confidence,
and let's up that a little higher, pride and arrogance. It's way beyond confidence. He's just full of pride and arrogance. No one's going to take us. And it was really an impenetrable city. And so for good reason, hey, let's just party. And he brings 1,000 of his men who probably shouldn't be out there making war plans. And he says, let's just have a drunken feast. He's really drunk on his own pride and arrogance. That's what's intoxicated him. And there's the biggest sin, one of the biggest sins that, well, God detests the proud, the haughty, the person that's arrogant that says, I don't need you, God. You know, I've done this all by myself. Well, we're going to see of his quick demise, because as Clinton came in, hey, I read about Belshazzar, and he only lasts for one chapter. It's true. He's only going to last for one chapter, okay? So, suddenly, what does that tell you? We're in verse 5. Suddenly, the fingers of man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Now, the word suddenly suggests what? Well, okay, it's immediately. What does that suggest? Because I think every word's important. All right, so they're doing this in worship to their idols, and then suddenly, what is this response of?
That scared him.
Huh?
That scared him a lot.
Well, it's going to scare him, but who is doing this writing? Who's acting suddenly? Is this a divine response to his blasphemous acts right there?
Yes.
That's what I want you to see, the connection. That sometimes God's very patient and long-suffering. He says, I'll get to you later. I'll deal with you later. I'll deal with you later. I'm using you right now, but when I'm done, I'll deal with you. But here, when he sees it, the arrogance and the pride, how quickly does God act? Boom. Suddenly. You see that? Now, here's a lesson. I don't know. Maybe I grew up in a generation where there's more hellfire and brimstone preaching. And I was always conscious that when I do things that are wrong, I'm in trouble. I just felt that right away. And then I realized, no, God's patient and long-suffering. He treats me as a child that's trying to learn. But you never want to lose that attitude, because you never know when God says, enough's enough. You don't know when it's going to come, your time. And so we should be very serious and cognizant of that my sins or my rebellion or my arrogance actually offends God. It offends him. It hurts him deeply. And don't take lightly his kindness and his grace, his forbearance, because it will come to an end, right? And that's where it says, suddenly. It's just boom, we're done. I'm done with this group of people. The finger, and I don't know if it's God's finger, but it says the finger of a man's hand, starts writing on the wall, on the plaster, and the king sees it, right? Now, let's go through some of the text. When the king's face, see it, here's his response. And his response gives you an indication of how traumatic or amazing this scene was. His face grew pale. Have you ever someone, their face goes white? You go, what is wrong with you? Did you just see a ghost? What was he doing just the last moment? Drinking, having fun, not a care in the world, and now pale. His thoughts alarmed him. What does that bring to mind to you? I say, do you ever talk about that? Like, man, my mind was alarmed, or my thoughts alarmed me. What would that mean? Scared. So your mind's racing through all these thoughts, like, what's going on the wall? You know, it's just, I know some of you like watching scary movies that are intended just to scare you. And when you see a person opening the door and peeking over and looking down into something, you go, don't look, you idiot. Because once you look, you know that something's going to jump out and get you. And sure enough, what do? They look out. Something jumps out and gets you. And what do you always do? You jump back yourself. All right? I can only imagine that kind of thoughts are racing. Said, what is going on? What kind of God is visiting us right now? Okay? And then he says his hip joints went slack. What does that mean? He just loses strength in his legs. And then you think this is just a thing for cartoons. What does his knees start doing? Knocking. Have you ever had your legs shake? Seriously, anyone here? Have you ever been rock climbing and sometimes you're so tense and tight, it's a phenomenon that happens when you're rock climbing that you're trying to take the next step and your leg just starts shaking. You have to hit it and hit it. And seriously, it happens. And then finally when you get your body under control, you can take the next step. This guy, he is scared to the bone, isn't he? Who had their hand up?
Right. In front of these thousands.
The nobles.
And then all of a sudden he's interrupted.
Right.
Because now something comes on the scene and he's alarmed. It's like, wait, what's going on? Like you said.
Good.
But then the other part of that is God's going to show him, obviously, those items that were taken from the temple, those were consecrated.
Yeah.
Those were made to the exact specifications that God asked.
Right.
If Aaron and the priests, if they did anything wrong, their whole life would be required of them.
Yeah.
And here's someone making fun of that.
And using them to worship an idol. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what does he do? He calls in the wise men. Have we seen this story before? Every time someone has a dream or vision, who do they call in? The wise men. You know, it's interesting. I made that note in your handout. It just seems like that in a times of tragedy or panic, we always turn to the people that can't help us the most until we exhaust all possibilities. And then when we tried everything, what do people often do at the last resort? Then finally turn to God, all right? And so they go to the wise man, and he says, if you could read this inscription and you could interpret it, I'm going to give you, clothe you with purple, that's royalty, a gold necklace, and I'll give you a third ruler in the kingdom. Here's my question. If you've been listening so far and you can put this together in your head, why the third and not the second? All right, who's the first? I knew you knew. That's right. Nabonidus. And who's the second? Belshazzar. And then who would be the third? Whoever do it. So you can't be second because you're third in line now. Now you're with me. You understand why he would say that. And that would give credence to the idea they're co-regents, right? Or co-rulers. So interesting, someone made this comment, so I thought I'd share it with you. The third rule over nothing still equals nothing. Now, why would I say that? That's a preview about what's going to happen, okay? A third rule over nothing still equals nothing. Yes?
Does this imply the writing, whatever it was not in standard Babylonian?
Good question. It's in the Hebrew, he asked, does this writing of the inscription, does it imply that it wasn't in Babylonian or some known language? In Daniel's text, it's in Aramaic, but that doesn't help us because it's all recorded in Aramaic. So some have suggested either it's an unknown language or somehow it was veiled from him understanding. Now, the answer I'm going to give you is,
I don't know.
Thank you. I don't know. Don't know. My best guess is it's something that they just didn't know. All right, but that's problematic too, because then Daniel could say anything, right? He could just make it up, and who would know the difference? So there's a real problem associated with what kind of language it was written in and why they couldn't understand it. Okay, so it's a good question. So the great glory promise. So all the kings could not. Now does Belshazzar even react more? He's greatly alarmed. If it wasn't bad before, it's even worse now. His face even grew paler, and his nobles are now confused. Like, what is going on? Can you imagine seeing a hand? I'm talking, and all of a sudden you see a hand. I don't know how large. It starts writing on the screen there. I mean, it would shock you, and would it move you, you know, and just alarm you. So now we find then the queen enters in. Now, this is probably... it could have been a daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, not necessarily the wife of the ruling king, because she remembers the history, and she's the one that comes in and says, why are you alarmed? Well, let's read it real quickly. So she entered the banquet, showing that she wasn't there. Who was he drinking with, by the way? His concubines, all these other women. The queen's not there. O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. Verse 11. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father and your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of different problems were found in Daniel. Now, how did Daniel get that? We know because God blessed him, right? She remembers all this, okay? So let Daniel be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation, okay? Now, I left a verse out of there, and I want you to see it in your Bible. Or maybe I did read it. Excuse me, I can't see it. No. All right, I'll pass on because I can't find what I was going to think about. So Daniel comes before the king. He's summoned. Oh, I skipped this part. Right. He's brought in. Now, notice, I don't know. See, it's interesting. You can read anything and put intonation or your tone of voice and make the king say something he's not saying and miss it altogether. Or you could, it might be correct. For example, when Jesus said, "Oh, how long should I put up with you?" Could you say it that way? Or like, "How long am I going to put up with you?" Is that a total different message? So it's hard sometimes to understand exactly what he's trying to say, but I think he's being arrogant with Daniel, and I'm going to tell you why. He says, "Are you the Daniel who's one of the exiles?" See, I'm putting it, see, in that kind of sarcastic way. "One of the people Nebuchadnezzar conquered from Judah, whom my father, the king, brought from Judah?" Is that a good way to introduce someone, welcome them? "Oh, you're one of the exiles." See, you think he's trying to position himself or posture as, "I'm the superior and you're just nothing," okay? "Now I've heard about you." Now that's interesting. When did he hear about him? Well, it sounded like just now. "That a spirit of God is in you. Now the wise men couldn't help me." Verse 16, "But I've heard about you, that you're able to give interpretation and solve difficult problems. Now if," and I highlight the word "if," because it could be sarcastic. "If you could actually do this, here's what I'll do for you. I'll give you a robe of purple, a gold necklace, and you'll be a third ruler." Because he's promised that to the others. Now, could it be that he's sincere in this? Because he is scared and legs shaking. It sounds like, though, there's a tone of arrogance and, like, "Okay, sure. If you can do this, fine. You're one of the exiles." That's why you have to love Daniel's response. So Daniel answered and said, first of all, he says, "I don't want your gifts. Keep your gifts." Isn't that interesting? Can you buy God's favor or no? "And give your rewards to someone else. But I'm going to read the inscription and I'm going to give you the interpretation. But I don't need anything from you." That's the first point. He rejects the king's offerings. And there's something to be said that for in our life. We don't need to be bribed or compromised. If you're going to do something and you're doing it because it's the right thing to do it without expecting anything back from it. Is that fair? Just do it. And he says, "O King, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to your Nebuchadnezzar, your father." He's going to give him a history lesson right now. And it's a history lesson that the king already knows but doesn't, think about very often. So Daniel's being very brave here. Now, he's an older man. And I think with old age, you just finally say, you know what you're dealing with. You know what to say. You've been around this block before. And you're just going to speak straight. And that's what he's doing. So he's going to give him a little history lesson about Nebuchadnezzar. Who gave Nebuchadnezzar his rule? He says, "The Most High God." Okay? And he's going to go on. He says, "And because of his grandeur, which he bestowed on him," God did, "all these people were given under his control. If he wants someone dead, what did he do? He killed him. If he wanted to spare him, what did he do? He spared him. And whoever he elevated, you know, into high position, he did it. If he wanted to humble him, he humbled him. So he had great power. He's acknowledging that, but he's saying, who gave it to him? Jehovah. Just remember that. When people have great power over you or over a country, and we see what they do, remember who rules over them still. It's Jehovah. And don't ever, ever forget it. Because here's the lesson that Nebuchadnezzar had even to learn. When his heart was lifted up, when did that happen? But when his heart was lifted up, arrogant. When? It's chapter 4, last week, standing on the roof and saying, look what I have done with my hand. And he says, Daniel already told him, you'd be made like a beast. And remember, we talked about that last week. His spirit became so proud, he behaved arrogantly. He was disposed from his royal throne, his glory was taken away from him. He was driven away from mankind, his heart was made like the beast, his dwelling was with the wild donkeys, he was given grass to eat, his body was drenched with the dew of the heaven. We studied this last week and showed that it's a real medical condition that causes it to happen. But it all happened until he recognized what? God is the ruler over the realm of mankind. God is. And I suggest anyone that does not recognize God's in charge is crazy. I mean, they're like a beast of the field. They're not, might not be crazy like an insane, you know, but they're crazy spiritually. They don't get it. And they're operating under a false paradigm that's just going to mess up their life. Because the first thing we have to understand, God is sovereign. He's in charge of everything. Everything. All right. And he gives it to whoever he wishes. Now, what does he say next? And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. Ouch. Did he know all this history? Now, if it's 60, 70 years later, that's interesting. Has this history been passed down? It has, hasn't it? Now, maybe not by the book of Daniel, but it's been passed down to us. But they knew about it. Belshazzar knew about it. Yes, Gary?
Well, him being the king's son, he would have been educated in the royal history.
That's right. They knew about it. So that's also this idea of him becoming like a beast of the field. Was that just a made-up story, or he's now appealing to it? You know this was true yourself. You don't pass down wild stories. They all knew it was true. It had such an impact on the nation that he said, yeah, I remember that story, but you forgot it. Now, so I'm going to look at Romans chapter 1. We have time enough to look at it. Because here we are today. You know, it's one thing for you and I to have this head knowledge. Yeah, God's in charge, and he rules over the kings of men. He rules over my life. But if you know it and don't act on it, we're just like King Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar, aren't we? I'm sorry? It is, isn't it?
Especially like election cycle, you're so into what's going on that you did great about reminding us often.
Yeah, because it is amazing what happens. And in fact, I was talking to Bob Buchanan about our trip into Kenya, hopefully this fall, and he said, I was told don't go in August because it's elections, national elections, and they're killing people, and it's not safe. They kill the opposition party. It's easy to get distracted about what's going on politically because they think you're in charge. You're going to put your man in the office by killing the opposition. It's actually happening. And so, yes, you're right. It is. So Romans chapter 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. Why? Because that which is known about God is evident within them, because God made it evident. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood, that which has been made, so they are without excuse. Verse 21, how clear was it? Even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. Now, who's he speaking of here? Who's he speaking of? Paul. Who are the they that knew God? Huh? Well, let's go back and look at it again. Well, verse 20, since the creation of the world, what's been made known? His invisible attributes, his internal power, his divine nature has been clearly seen, be understood through how? What has been made? What's that refer to? So when you look at the creation, what do you learn? What do you have to come to a conclusion of? There is a God who designed all this. It just couldn't happen by chance. So who's he speaking about when he says they all knew him? Everyone, but Gentiles. That's right, specifically. But it's everyone, because the Jews already accepted God. So he's saying all the rest knows there's a God. That's why I stop arguing with people to prove there's a God, because guess what? They already know it. I just got to deal with them like Daniel does. You already know this. You already know there's a God. And sometimes they just need permission to believe in God. All right? But the problem is when you don't want to acknowledge God. See, now what it says? Even though they knew God, they did not honor him or give him thanks. And when you do that, what happens to your head and your thinking? They became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. They exchanged the glory of God, the incorruptible God, for an image in the form of incorruptible man, of birds and four-footed animals and birds. So they started worshiping the creation rather than the creator. Does that happen all the time around us? That's why I say people that don't want to acknowledge God are crazy. Because there is more concern for our environment and for taking care of this earth, Mother Earth, than there is for honoring God and doing what is right. In fact, I have a survey that shows when it comes to pornography and all that, when they're asking youth, people from a teen to like 30 years old, what you think is immoral, number three or four on the list is not taking care of the environment by recycling. Do you know where pornography is on the list for them? Number eight, as being something that's immoral. So in other words, it's more immoral to not recycle than to subject someone to the vials of pornography and objectifying women, all the things that go on there. Is that an upside-down world? And that's why I say they're crazy in their thinking, and it affects you and me, doesn't it? Because the world starts getting in our head, and I'm not saying those things aren't important, but there's a hierarchy of importance, right? And if I don't honor God with all my life and give him thanks for everything that I have, I start thinking crazy. Right? That's what happens. And why I say that is because look what Belshazzar's doing. And guess what? He knew it, didn't he? He knew who's in charge. It wasn't him. He knew it was God that gave it to his father, his forefather, Nebuchadnezzar. And he knew, should know, that God gave him rule too. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say? But what did he do since he refused to give him honor? What does it say? He exalted himself against God. So that's the necessary consequence. When you refuse to honor God, you end up opposing God. And how did he do it? By taking these cups out of the temple and using them to worship his idols. That's a direct challenge against God. All right? Daniel's pretty brave, isn't it? He says, yeah, you brought these vessels. You had your concubine and wives, and you're drinking wine from them. You praise the gods of silver, gold, bronze, and iron, wood, and stone, who don't see or hear or understand. But the God, now here's this a beautiful language, in whose hand are your life, breath, and your ways? Now, could that be said for all of us? Yeah. Your life and your breath is in God's hands. And when he just goes, what happens to you? You're dead. I mean, does that happen? Remember, there was a guy in Acts 12 who gave a speech at Caesarea Maritime, and when the people were done listening to him, he said, not the voice of a man, but the voice of a God. And he did not stop them. And what happened to him? Acts chapter 12. He died. It says he was eaten from the worms internally because he gave the glory that it was supposed to belong to God, he took for himself. All right? And God holds our life, our ways in his hands. And it behooves us just to humbly seek him and honor him and thank him for everything we have. We want him to bless that. Because when things go wrong, it's usually because I've sowed seeds that were wrong. And now I'm bearing the consequences of it. Yes?
I think as you get older, you realize that it's God who wakes you up every morning. And with that being said, it changes your attitude and understanding that you know that you just have today.
That's right.
You don't even have this afternoon. You just
That's right. And that's why I'm so thankful he's so patient with us, okay? So then the hand, he says, here it was. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Isn't that beautiful? It's just like everything in Daniel you can repeat. Nebuchadnezzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And you can say this one, what is it? Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. All right, so what does that mean? Here it is. He says, now I'm going to interpret it for you. Here it is. Mene means numbered, or right here. We're reading it from right to left. That's the way they do in Aramaic. Numbered. God's numbered your kingdom and you're found deficient. And he says it twice to emphasize it, right? We've done this twice. You do not measure up. Tekel means you've been weighed on the scales and your life and your righteousness, you're so deficient. Now, Perez means divided. Your kingdoms have been divided, and it's going to be given to the Medo-Persian. Where did we first learn of that? Daniel 2, the head of gold, the chest of silver. Who was that? The Medo-Persians. Daniel's told this 70 years ago, nearly. And now it's going to come true. And so handwriting in the wall is to say it will be divided or it has been divided. When you're able to read this, it's already too late. When the handwriting's on the wall, your time is up. It's not like it's going to be up. It's already over. So here's what happens. Belshazzar, this is amazing. Rather than be indignant at him, because what did Daniel just tell him? You're over. He says, okay, thank you. Here's a robe. Here's a necklace. I'll make you third of my kingdom. Well, he held to his promise at least, okay? But that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom at age 62. It was over that night. Now, look on your chart and we're done. Because I gave you a little history. See on the little sidebar on the backside page? This is all history because what the Medes did, they actually diverted the flow of the Euphrates River into a nearby swamp. This lowered the level of the water enough below the river gates that all the soldiers could enter the city through those gates. And they still would not have been able to enter had not the bronze gates and inner walls have been left inexplicably unlocked. But if you look in Isaiah 44, it says God will open the gates, speaking of when the Persians or the Medes come and take Babylon. And they found them unlocked. And so, literally, God opened the city for the Medo-Persians, and they took the city without a battle. That very night, what are they doing with their 1,000 people?
Partying.
Like, we're so great, no one can take us. Dead. That quick. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. When you've been numbered and the handwriting's on the wall, it's over. It's over. That speaks of the great judgment that's about to come. All right. So real quickly, lessons learned. The king already knew, and so do we, don't we?
Yeah.
We already know. Pride will be broken by God, always, always. And then thirdly, blessings which do not produce thankfulness, thankful worship. Are we blessed? If they don't produce gratitude and thankfulness and humbleness, they will always produce arrogant rebellion. Because you start thinking, I deserve it, or I did it on my own. So let's be very careful and always be a thankful people. All right, any questions or comments? We're done.